This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks so much for joining us. The recent attacks on the satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo for their depiction of the Prophet Muhammad has reignited public discussion about the appropriateness of satirizing and even drawing the religious deity. Still, the use of deadly threats against those who conjure up unflattering images of Muhammad is nothing new. It happened in 2005 when a Danish newspaper printed deliberately controversial cartoons, and before that, in 1989, novelist Salman Rushdie was targeted because of scenes in his book, The Satanic Verses. Then Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, issued a fatwa on the writer. Rushdie was forced to go into hiding to protect his life, adopting the pseudonym Joseph Anton. He joined me in 2013 to discuss his book, Joseph Anton, a Memoir, which chronicled his 9 years in hiding. As we certainly know about you, you lived under the threat of a death sentence for about 9 years.
Yeah, or even more, really. But it was, a lot of people, particularly in England, began to feel that because I hadn't been killed, that nobody had been trying to kill me, that it was all exaggerated. But the fact is, first of all, that it wasn't only I who was threatened. The publishers of the novel, its translators, etc., were under threat in many countries, and there were attacks.
In fact, a translator was killed.
The Japanese translator, Professor Igarashi, was murdered at his college late one night when he was working late. The Italian translator was seriously attacked and was very lucky to survive. And my Norwegian publisher, William Nygaard, was shot 3 times in the back and survived by a miracle. And as you know, there were attacks on bookstores around the world, including here in the United States. Cody's bookstore in Berkeley was pipe bombed. There were firebombs in other places too. It was a very, very real attack.
Did you feel, though, during that time, did you have not regret so much, but a sense of responsibility? As you said, people paid, in certain cases, almost with his life.
Well, you can't help feeling, that if friends and colleagues of yours are being threatened and attacked, you can't help feeling responsible. But I remember very well when William Nygaard, my Norwegian publisher, had recovered sufficiently from the wounds for me to be able to speak to him on the phone. The first thing he said to me was, "This is not your fault." He said, "I'm a perfectly grown-up person. I knew what I was doing when I published your book. I'm very proud to be the publisher." And then in true heroic publisher style, he said, "By the way, we've just ordered a very large reprint." And I thought, to say that from your hospital bed when you've got 3 bullet holes in you is a genuinely courageous act.
Do you think the critics, did they understand the book or did they misunderstand the book?
Well, many people didn't read it. Many people were just pointed in a certain direction by extremist priests and just believed what they were being told and went that way. There are 1 or 2 cases I quote in the book of people much later who had been involved in the protests coming up to me and saying that they had since then had actually read the book and they couldn't see what the fuss was about, even though they had been the people making the fuss. So that was frustrating. I think what's fair to say is that the relatively short part of the Satanic Verses that deals with this material in a dream sequence is, if you like, a kind of dissident view of the birth of a religion, because I'm not a religious person. So I'm looking at religion and the phenomenon of revelation from the point of view of someone who's skeptical about it. And I guess there are people who don't like that.
Mm. But you also seem to say that Khomeini was using this fatwa for his own political purposes Iran.
I don't think that's even really in dispute anymore. This was not long after Iran's Iraq war had ended in a kind of debacle. And the revolution was probably in more trouble than it's ever been, since it happened. And he was looking for a way to rally the troops, and it was just as my bad luck to be Khomeini's last stand.
Right. A sort of a diversion for him.
A diversion for him in a way of kind of re-energizing the faithful. And that, unfortunately, turned out to be me.
I got the feeling that, and I don't want to go too much out on a limb on this, is that this fatwa was the beginning of extremist acts. I'm not saying it led to 9/11, but yeah. but there might be a circuitous path from this fatwa to, you know, something like 9/11.
I think there's pretty much a straight line. You know, actually, I mean, one of the things that I try and show in the book is how that line goes. You know, that's something which began as what seemed like a bizarre, marginal, kind of one-off, weird thing. You know, which didn't seem to be symbolic of any larger project. You know, how we gradually can see how that project enlarged. You know, and I think I came to think that what happened to me was a kind of prologue. You know, and yes, the 9/11 attack was the main event, if you like. You know, but you can, I think, see the growth of that kind of malevolent, kind of medievalist assault using modern technology. You know, how it grew during those years. Many other people were attacked all over the world, and then climaxing in this terrible event in America.
I saw a quote about, and this is about the satanic verses, and about you saying, you say, it's not an evil book and I'm a good person.
Yeah, this is, you know, there's a section in the memoir which I call the trap of wanting to be loved. And I think the problem is we're all guilty of that. We all want people to think well of us. We all want to be the good guy. And certainly when this trouble started, there was a bit of me which thought, if I could just explain it to people, they will understand that they've made a mistake, you know, and then we can all be reasonable and shake hands and get on with our day. And that was
naive, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a delusion. And it was, I think, in a way helpful to me to lose that idea that if I just say the right thing, everybody will love me. And I thought, well, these people who aren't going to love me, well, you know, it's okay because I'm not that wild about them either.
if you knew a fatwa was a possibility, would you write the satanic verses any differently?
And I think the answer is yes, because I'm actually very proud of that novel. I mean, I think it is very close to being the best novel I ever wrote. I mean, it's certainly, in my view, one of the best. And what I like is that now that the fuss has died down, is that finally a lot of people are reading it, you know, just as a novel instead of as a hot potato. And a lot of people like it, you know. And my view is I don't see why the opinion of the people who like it matters less than the opinion of the people who didn't read it and didn't like it, you know. So I think maybe it's time that the people who like the book have their turn.
You write at the very end of the book, and it seems like when the fatwa is lifted or you feel safe enough to live in the world, you're no longer Joseph Anton. You're now Salman Rushdie.
Yes, I was very happy.
Did it feel like I'm sort of shedding this identity?
I hated having that. I mean, one of the reasons I made it the title of the book is just to dramatize for people how weird it is to be asked to give up your name.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very weird thing. It's one thing, you know, there are writers who want pseudonyms and so on and like to, but I was never a writer of that kind. But in your personal life, to be asked for security reasons to give up your own name, it's a bizarre thing. And I thought it would, in a way, dramatize the bizarreness of those years if that was the title. Joseph Anton, a memoir, it ends up being me, you know. It's
especially
odd.
Written in the third person.
Yeah. So the day I could lay him to rest was a happy day, yeah.
Are you still friends with your guards or some of the guards
some
that
them,
you
write
about?
Some of them, yes. In fact, when we had the book publication for the memoir in England, I invited a lot of them, and a lot of them came, you know. And now they because they were off duty, they could drink, which they couldn't back then.
Did they call you Joe?
They tried very hard. They almost did, actually. I saw it beginning to slip out of their minds, but they controlled themselves.
I saw something that you said this summer that really interested me. Was that actually at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, you said, I do think that one of the characteristics of our age is the growth of this culture of offendedness. It has to do with the rise of identity politics, whether you're invited to define your identity quite narrowly, you know, Western, Islamic, whatever it might be. But I was interested in this culture of offendedness.
I mean, I think it's a very worrying thing that people seem to feel that their identity is best expressed by the things they are against, you know, the things that upset them or annoy them or allegedly insult or offend them, you know. And because, of course, if you were to use that really as a guiding principle, everything offends somebody.
Of course.
You know, and it means there would be no books in the bookstores, there'd be no movies in the movie theaters, you know, nobody would be able to speak, you know. And in any kind of genuinely free society, we just deal with the fact that people are going to say things, write things, you know, make movies that we don't like, you know, and you just have to deal with it. But now it seems as if there's a project amongst many groups to try and prevent the expression of things that they don't like, you know, and that's, of course, in a country which prides itself on the First Amendment, that's a big problem.
Do you think it also, I mean, as you were talking that way, I was thinking about just how the Twitterverse, for instance, is just alive with people slamming other people. You get to be anonymous in certain ways. It allows people to be more offended offensive.
Yeah, I do think the anonymity question is quite a problem because you're quite right. It allows people to be rude, discourteous, in a way that they would not be if their name was known and they were sitting in the room with you. And I worry that it's bringing up generation after generation of people who think it's okay to be viciously rude without any excuse or justification, just because you feel like it, because you're trolling somebody. On the other hand, of course, there are people who defend the anonymity by saying that, particularly in countries where there are authoritarian regimes or whatever, that the anonymity allows the public to protest.
Sure. You know, look at Iran a couple of years ago.
Iran, Egypt, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a thorny question. But there's no doubt that sometimes there's an advantage in the anonymity. But sometimes, yes, it leads to kind of colossal rudeness of a kind that's worrying.
Does anything offend you?
Oh, lots of things offend me. You know, the novels of Dan Brown. but I think he should probably live.
And that's the difference, right?
And that's the difference, yeah.
But do you think it's come down to that?
No, I mean, I think it's, you know, I hope that some of this tide, I mean, these things are cyclical, you know, and I know that, for instance, a lot of the people who protested against the Satanic Verses 25 years ago now publicly say that they regret it, that they thought it was a mistake, you know. Some of them think it's a mistake for tactical reasons, which is they said, oh, it just made him more famous and sold more of his books.
And there's some truth to that, isn't
there? There is some truth to that. And some of them feel it was a mistake because they've, in a way, accepted the free speech argument, which is that if they get to say what they want to say, people who disagree with them must also be allowed to say what they want to say.
One of the arguments is that some people have more free speech than others. And by that, I mean, if you're Dan Brown or perhaps Salman Rushdie, chances are you have a bigger audience for your speech.
No question. No question. But I mean, I think here is one of the things that the First Amendment really gets right. It's better to allow unpleasant things to be said than to prevent difficult things from being expressed. You know, so the rule is everything's allowed. And I mean, I must say it's worrying when you see some of the ugliness that is expressed in the name of free speech. You know, but the problem is, how do you start silencing it? Who decides where the limit is? And if you're going to err in one direction or the other, I think to err in the direction of too much freedom is better than erring in the direction of too little.
That was my 2013 conversation with novelist and essayist Salman Rushdie, who would join me to discuss his book, Joseph Anton, A Memoir. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. When we get back, we'll hear my conversation with author Alexandra Fuller, whose award-winning memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, will be reissued as a Picador classic this year. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We turn now to my conversation with author and memoirist Alexandra Fuller. Her award-winning book, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, will be reissued this year as a Picador classic. The memoir describes her European family and their time living in Rhodesia, now known as Zimbabwe, during the Rhodesian Bush War. She joined me in 2011 when she released a follow-up memoir called Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness, which further explored her family's time in Africa. This time, the book focuses more on her mother, a proud and staunch politically incorrect Scot with a tough love view of parenting. I began my conversation with Fuller with a question about her eccentric mother. She did, and I don't know if she still does, refer to your first memoir as that awful book, but I also got the sense that she loved being in that book as well.
I don't think so. No, she was appalled. The things that appalled her about being in that book weren't the things that would appall most American mothers. Most American mothers would be horrified if their daughter wrote about them being so drunk that not only did they not even closely resemble their passport photo, but they have to be wrapped in a tarpaulin and thrown in the back of a pickup to make the border crossing between Zambia and Zimbabwe because they can no longer sit up in the passenger seat.
So that wasn't a problem for her?
Not a problem. The problem, nor actually, was my mother as worried as most people would be that I had displayed her bigotry in all its, you know, uncensored unglory. I think the thing that really challenged my mother was that the book undid the myth of herself, which was this veneer of unbelievable toughness, which isn't to say that toughness doesn't go to the core. But what it spoke about was that there had been loss in our family and that behind closed doors, my mother grieved the loss of her children physically and deeply and all the way down to her soul. And yet when she walked out of those doors, the impression I think that she wanted to give the world was that she was okay. And, you know, I think the thing that Cocktail Hour addresses was that my mother said, challenged me after dinner, let's go to the dogs tonight. She said, you know, you don't actually know me. You have written a book about your experience of me, but you don't know who I am. You don't know what my motivations are. You don't even know where I'm from. And I said, that's fair enough. I did that thing that reporters do, which is I actually interviewed my mother.
Hard to imagine.
Well, the interviews didn't go well.
I think she would be hard to interview as someone who interviews for a living.
I went to Scotland to do the interviews. I wanted to be in the country where it was illegal to have armed weapons close at hand. And
we should say to people who haven't read these memoirs that your parents are largely armed in this first in the first memoir.
Armed and unafraid of alcohol. Yeah, and the combination of the two. So, you know, being in Scotland, I thought would be sort of neutral territory. And I did hours and hours and hours of interviews with her, but my sort of abiding memory of the feeling surrounding those interviews was that it was a eugenics lesson. My mother telling me, you know, I have 200 bazillion% Scottish Highland blood, which makes me purer than anyone, and you were either switched at birth or there's a rumor of Armenian blood on your father's side, and I think it all got distilled in your body because no child of mine would have done this disloyal thing.
And the voice that you just said, that is what your mother sounds like.
We sound so similar that on the tapes, when I was listening to the recording, the only way that I could distinguish between us is that she is so politically incorrect that she makes Sean Hannity look like Oprah. So you can tell it's her speaking versus my rather astonished answers.
Has she read this book?
She has read this book.
And what does she call it?
Another awful book.
Does she?
Babe has written another awful book.
Is that now a compliment?
You know, at some point you just have to take everything my mother says as a compliment.
So as you say, and oftentimes in this book, she's referred to as Nicola Fuller of Central Africa.
Gave herself that name.
Which could be a title in and of itself, yes?
Well, you know, the idea that my mother would have such a strong sense of self. My 18-year-old daughter recently went to Africa to stay with my parents. Yeah. So my daughter came back and shaking her head and said, my God, you underwrote that woman.
She's that powerful a person.
Well, and she had taken my daughter and several of my sister's children. As my mother says, my sister has produced a litter of children. So she is taking this litter of children on a death march, which I'd warned Sarah about, but my mother's a big believer that children and dogs require plenty of fresh air and exercise, so you get marched off on one of these death marches. There was a baobab tree with a great big hole in it, and Mum said, we should go and explore that tree. It's very interesting. I think something might be nesting in it. And they get up, and sure enough, there's a bee's nest, actually, and the bees are beginning to swarm, which I think is fairly sort of iffy anywhere, but in Africa, it's really not good. So Mum sees this and she grabs her dogs, and she swats her grandchildren to the ground and flees for the tree of forgetfulness, leaving my daughter as the eldest grandchild to pick up the remaining granddaughters. And when my, you know, daughter confronted her with her, she said, you know, grandchildren, easy come, easy go. However, karma being what it is, my mother was the only person who got stung, and she's quite allergic to bees. And her face swelled up And she was thrilled. She says, look at that. I don't have a single wrinkle on the side of my face. It's nature's Botox. I look fabulous. I wonder if I can go down to the tree and persuade them to sting me on the other side of my face. And Sarah just said, she is so irrepressible. She overrides everything. You can't really be in the same room with her and share space.
Do you think she loves her dogs more than her children and grandchildren?
Well, I will say something about my mother. She's managed to be incredibly racist at the point of taking it to sort of science, really. But she's not speciesist. So she doesn't really think that dogs are a lower or lesser species than humans. In fact, very often I actually would argue that animals are, in fact, elevated far beyond humans. And you know what? As her daughter, there's a point at which you accept that. The great gift, I think, of being raised with someone like that is you're under no illusions or disillusions that you're in any way special. When you get flung out into the world, you are just another soul among souls. It's not that I don't think she loves me at all, I think. I mean, I think she does love her children. I just think she has this kind of capacity to truly love animals.
Well, what's interesting is, as you say, she is a racist, and I would have to say, reading about her, she certainly comes across that way. She names her dogs things like Che. I mean, she names them for revolutionaries, but she's a colonialist.
Well, she did also name a dog Papa Doc.
That's true. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it sort of, she has a very colonial view of Africa, wouldn't you say?
Well, I would say this one. When my parents were being raised, they're both British, even though my mother was raised in Kenya. I think the sort of view then of being British was that if you were British, that was fantastically lucky for you. And if you weren't British, then your culture was just a failed attempt at being British. And if you would just allow yourself to be colonized, everything would turn out fabulously for you.
Oh, my goodness.
And you know, I think that was a very deadly attitude. And I mean it in every sense of the word. I don't just mean deadly, obviously, for the millions and millions of people who were oppressed by that kind of thinking, but it was deadly, too, for the people who were doing the oppressing. Very hard to concentrate on much else when you are so busy squashing the powers that you consider are beneath you, which, of course, they never are. There came a moment in my parents' life when they were in their late 50s when they had lost everything. They had lost the wars. They had lost children. My sister and I had left home. They did not even have a roof over their heads. Somebody had lent them stay in a little cottage outside of Lusaka. And my mother had most catastrophically lost her mind. And my father did something that I can really only express as a vision quest. Took a packet of cigarettes, walked out on the Zambezi Escarpment Ridge, and sat there overlooking the valley for a couple of days until the answer came to him. And he came back and said to my mother, Africa is for the Africans. We've done this wrong.
And what was her response?
She said, okay. Then we are Africans, so be it. And so now how do we go forward? Having fought, having used up so much energy and sweat, having spent so much blood on being British in Africa, to now accept your Africanness and everything that that means, that you will be buried here, that you will go down as an African in every way. To accept that was a kind of profound peace.
Did they live differently as a result of that?
Did
they see their black African neighbors differently because of that?
I think that shift had already started. Probably, I would say in the early 80s, I would say that shift had already started to happen. I mean, there's a point at which it's ridiculous to keep on striving in your whiteness.
You also say, and there's this deep connection they have to land in where they have lived in Africa. Land is mom's love affair, and it is dad's religion. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that their marriage, which is wildly successful, has always been a bit of a love triangle, in that at the center and heart of it has been their shared passion for land. For my father, land there is something sacred to it, the way that he paces it, that he, it's compulsive for him to be in a place and to feel the need to stand unshod upon the earth, to smell it. And you can see, I know him well enough, that he's calculating that soil's capacity to hold water, or he can feel its need for nitrogen, or for, you know, and he would know what to plant in that soil. And so for him, it is a very organic thing. And he's just turned 70, and so he's been banging on about the fact that he's had a 3 score year and 10, and that's it. He's not going to bat some other chap's innings, and that's not cricket. So he's planning to die any minute.
How did they meet?
Well, my father grew up in, as my mother says, at the damp, boiled cabbage smelling hell of England, and just couldn't wait to get out. He'd been raised with a fair amount of material comfort and icy emotional landscape. And so I think for him, a physical urge to get somewhere warm and away from, I think, the way that the English had, you know, in the 50s were sort of in their little isolated separateness and this kind of locked down chilliness that came after the war, the rations, you know, I mean, things were still being rationed then. So he went to Canada, and that was really cold. Found himself in the West Indies, really enjoyed that. It was fairly alcoholic, lots of rum punches, and then found a job in East Africa. And he said, well, I've always wanted to see a giraffe. He wasn't planning to stay. He got the job. He arrived in Kenya 2 or 3 weeks after the beginning of independence, and he had a job on the wattle plantation. He was sent to the airport to pick somebody else up. He can't remember who that person was now. But what he saw getting off the aeroplane was my mother, who had been sent to finishing school in London in the vain hope that she learned. They tried to civilize me. But she got off the aeroplane, and my dad said, you've just never seen anything like it. She took your breath away. And you can tell. She still astonishes him, not so much with her beauty, but with her courage. The bravest woman I have ever met. And I think my mother thought she would never leave Kenya. I think it was absolutely, she knew that she was having this heavenly sort of childhood. And it was very cinematic. I mean, I think she's always had this sense of herself. In an odd way, she has a writer's mind in the way that she is already making a story out of something before it's happened.
Your mother describes, and in your book is based in many ways on interviews that you had with her, and I guess others as well, your father included, describing, and this is in Kenya, the sort of Happy Valley set. I mean, it seems that she was both sort of part of this set, but not part of this set at all. And she also describes a really horrible, tragic thing that happened to her when she was, I guess, a young woman or even a teenager.
Well, it was her mother came out to Kenya as a governess and was taking care of this awful woman, her name, my mother's, Inky Porter, and she, you know, my mother has this unbelievable sort of sharp mind to have attached onto these incredible details, and Inky Porter was a white hunter, very bored at finding herself pregnant right in the middle of hunting season, so she carried on drinking gallons of gin and snorting, as my mother says, mountains of cocaine, and when this baby was born, Inky Porter threw it at my grandmother, who was a My mother and I couldn't quite settle on a word for what my grandmother was, but she was essentially a nanny. And then went off to go hunting and, you know, whatever it was that Inky Porter did. And this baby died of withdrawal in my grandmother's arms. And that forever set my mother against the Happy Valley set. And it was interesting. Until I had written and done this book, I'd always sort of felt that my mother, in a way, must have been associated with the Happy Valley set. I mean, she is hard drinking. She's got a lot of those sort of hedonistic characteristics. Oh, we're here right now. Charge on regardless of whatever. But in the narrative of herself and in her own experience, that wasn't what she was. She was much more land attached. She found the White Mischief Happy Valley set. They were just there for the party. They weren't there deeply in love with the land. And they died in hedonistic droves. They weren't there for the long haul. And my mother was all about the long haul. Her life was on track to be this thing that she had in mind for herself. It only came unraveled, I think, because they violated a basic rule, which was that they moved down into Rhodesia, which was at that time a rebel country that had set itself apart from the world. And in spite of the world's distress of what Rhodesia was doing, having declared itself unilaterally independent from Britain. And it was that rebelliousness that I think started this tragic train of events. Mm-hmm. They receded. You know, I think the whites from across Africa either left the continent or they receded further south to countries that were still white-run, South Africa and Rhodesia. And there was a violence in the intention of that act that had a very long half-life, and that became incredibly personal in the instance mm-hmm. of my family.
Do you see them? Do you see your parents as tragic?
No.
Heroic?
No.
Troubled?
No. Wow. That's a really good question. I see them as having no regrets, and there is something. So I see them as having the courage of their convictions, however misguided those convictions sometimes were, and that they have seen that there was a terrible cost to those convictions, but they had the convictions nonetheless and have lived with the ghastly consequences of it. Mm. They have paid a tremendous price for their bigotry. Most people don't have to pay for their views and opinions in quite the way that my parents have with blood.
And how do you mean that? I mean, just the way they live their life?
Yes, and I think a lot of people can carry on the sort of rather bigoted, unconscious way. And really, what consequences happen to them? I mean, so some people might not talk to them, or, you know, they may not have a wide circle of friends, or they may be, you know, people roll their eyes at them, or I don't know. But I mean, when your beliefs lead you to a place where then so much tragedy ensues, where you are then forced to fight in a war, where you have to take a stand because of your beliefs, I think a lot of people would be a lot more careful about what they believed in if yeah. it meant that for 6 months of the year, for nearly a decade, they had to go into the bush with a gun and fight to defend those beliefs.
That was my conversation with author Alexandra Fuller, who joined me in 2011 to discuss her memoir, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back, we'll listen to my conversation with Ingrid Croce, widow of musician Jim Croce, about the late singer who would have turned 72 last week. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're hearing the 1972 song Bad, Bad Leroy Brown, the biggest hit by South Philadelphia native Jim Croce. The late singer-songwriter would have turned 72 last week. His widow, Ingrid Croce, joined me in the studio back in 2012 to discuss her late husband, who died in a plane crash in 1973. Ingrid Croce co-authored a book about her late husband with her current husband called I Got a Name, The Jim Croce Story. Let's listen. What was Jim Croce like? And your book in many ways is about him, and it's about your relationship with him. There certainly were tough times, and we'll talk about that. But I think for those of us who remember him was that mustache and the blue jean jacket.
He was a person who, first of all, he was brilliant and able to be a good listener. He was not necessarily a good student. He was quick-witted. And most important, I think he was the most generous human being I've ever met.
Really?
Yes, he literally gave away the shirt on his back. He never had anything. He just kept giving everything. And his family was extremely generous as well. They always would bring Villanova students to the house for excellent food. Jim's mom was a great cook, Northern Italian food. It was just, you could smell the roasted peppers and garlic from the street. It was just always delicious.
Well, Ingrid, I know that this book has been a long time coming, has had, I guess, various incarnations. Here it is published and took you back to, obviously, some of the good times, but also some of the tough times that you had with Jim Croce. Did it help you settle, perhaps, some of those dark times?
It did. We started the book. We did 4 years of interviews with family and friends and fans. When we finished the book, quite honestly, the publisher at that time said that they really were interested more in the stories. They didn't really want the real story. You know, they wanted a story that was about the characters in the songs. And that wasn't what we wanted. And we just said, you know, here's the advance. We will take the book and we'll move forward. And I wasn't ready then. I really think I wasn't ready. And then a year and a half ago, it was time. It was truly time. And I had been raped when I was in Mexico, you know, when shortly after Jim and I got married. And I was truly afraid to tell him. And when I finally, when he came to Mexico, I'd won a fellowship through Moore and was doing my painting and my pottery. And when he came to Mexico and I told him, his reaction was you know, angry, as I expected it to be. I mean, back then, even now, but back then even more so, it was always the woman's fault.
He hits you when you tell him about being raped.
Yes, it was a different time. You know, people have a different attitude now about rape, but back then it was the woman's fault. And, you know, I actually got involved in a group called the Center for Community Solutions, oh gosh, about a dozen years ago. And slowly but surely, we've been listening to different speakers. And eventually, over the years, I kind of recognized that the behavior that both of us had was exactly book perfect for, you know, what occurred for our marriage, not to mention how fame then affected it. But I mean, just because, you know, Jim felt so helpless about what had happened and therefore angry. And I felt responsible somehow, and so therefore passive.
Yeah.
And we played the roles, and the anger built. And by the time we hit a certain stage in life, rather than exploding, something happened amazingly, which we got an album on Capitol Records, the opportunity for the album. I was in my senior year at Moore, and I wanted to finish. I came home from school one day, and dinner, of course, was on the table. He used to make me dinner every night, and he said, "And we've got a chance to do an album on Capitol Records." And I looked at him and I knew it was time. I just said, "Yes, let's do it." And he was so excited. So it really changed the dynamic for a while.
And was this the album You Don't Mess Around With Jim?
This was the album on Capitol, Jim and Ingrid Croce.
Ah.
And we traveled the country on the college concert circuit and did really traveled about 100,000 miles by car every year for about almost 2 years. And we just had the time of our lives doing this. I mean, he'd play guitar while we traveled 13 hours sometimes to get to a college just in time to play. I mean, it was a crazy schedule, but we made no money, but we really loved what we were doing.
You lived for a while in Lindale, Pennsylvania. In fact, sounds like you were kind of a garden farm girl.
Yes.
And he was doing construction.
Yes. My first time in the country. I grew up in the city. So, but it was a great experience. We came back from New York City. We'd lived in the Bronx. Well, we never were there, but we used to travel from the Bronx. We were just so happy to be doing music because it was music and not dealing with the business. And then I got pregnant.
Yeah.
But right before I got pregnant, we used to have all kinds of visitors, everyone from Arlo Guthrie and Jimmy Buffett and Manhattan Transfer, all kinds of people. Our house was kind of like the original Croce's restaurant because I used to cook. I used to get everything out of our garden, and Jim would always be busy with the guitar in his hand, so I got to cook and wash dishes.
Lucky you.
But it was so much fun. And we lived in a very teeny little apartment. It was really, really
teeny.
In a
teeny little town, wasn't it?
Well, Lindale, it was a house that was broken into three different areas, and we lived in the smokehouse area. Oh. It was a big fireplace and a teeny little living room and a small kitchen and a teeny bedroom upstairs. I mean, really, really small. But it was wonderful, and we were just really happy there. And then when I got pregnant, Jim realized this was his last chance to make music.
Because, I mean, he wasn't, can we say he wasn't a very good business person?
That we could say that without any question. I can tell you some stories that would make you
laugh. I mean, as you said, he would give, you know, literally the shirt off his back.
Yes, but he wasn't a good business person. I think he would admit to it. He just liked to give. That was it. He was a giver.
Well, I do want to play a hit song called Time in a Bottle. I think people will recognize it again from this 1972 album, You Don't Mess Around with Jim. Can you?
Can I tell you a little bit about this song?
Please.
Because the night that we found out that I was pregnant, because I didn't know that I was pregnant. We'd been together 5 years and I'd never gotten pregnant. And so we were like blown away when we found this out. So he came home that night, and beside being really nervous about it because he realized, you know, that this was his last opportunity to make music or he'd never do it once he had a child. So he sat down at the kitchen table, which we always sat at the table to write and sing. And I have to say that he had such a history, I mean, a lot of history in his life. He could do things that were really, really old pieces of music and classical music. And he could also take haiku and put it into a 2.5-minute song. So you get all the images. But this song came from somewhere in the past. This was part of his structure. He knew this song even before he sang it, I think. And he pretty much wrote this song all the way through. And then, of course, Maury Muehleisen came into our lives, who was the guitar player and wonderful, wonderful artist and person. And Maury really did the counterpoint for this. And it just mm-hmm. made this song so beautiful. And so in a sense, you know, I guess it was written for AJ, for me, for the world to know there isn't enough time, so use it wisely.
Prescient words. Let's listen to Time in a Bottle again from Jim Croce's 1972 album, You Don't Mess Around with Jim.
If I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do save every day till eternity passes away, just to spend them with you. If I could make days last forever, if words could make wishes come true, I'd save every day like a treasure, and then again I would spend them with you. But there never seems to be enough time to do the things you want to do once you find them. I've looked around enough to know that you're the one I want to go through time with.
And again, Time in a Bottle, performed by Jim Croce from his 1972 album, You Don't Mess Around with Jim. Well, he was on the road a lot, and I think this happens with a lot of musicians, is there are groupies, there are affairs, and that had to have been tough for you.
You know, it was really tough, but most importantly, the thing that was tough for me is that I felt that the distance between us was the hardest part of all. It wasn't the sex. I know that sounds weird, but it really wasn't the sex. It was the friendship. It was the closeness that we had together that broke my heart. And in the end, you know, it was getting better. And yeah. I think that he was really coming around to what was important to him, family and friends. And, you know, I don't know. I had a great belief. I look at Jimmy Buffett and I look at Arlo Guthrie, and they're still with the same woman they were with. Yeah. And, you know, somehow it works out. You get through all that and you come to the end. So who would have known? Who knows what would have happened? But, you know, I believed at the end, especially with the letter that came at the very end, that that it was okay, that it was all going to work itself out.
You describe him coming back from what sounds like a pretty long tour, and he had written kind of a groupie song,
yeah,
and played it for you or wanted you to hear it and hear the lyrics.
Yeah, I think he was trying to tell me in his own funny way that, you know, hey, Inga, I'm sleeping around, I'm doing this and that, but, you know, I'll have to say I love you in a song came right after that. So, you know, it's a very typical story. I don't think that anybody gets through fame without it. I mean, it's being offered to you on a plate. How do you, you know, I mean, our presidents and our, you know, there isn't a person who gets through fame without having this kind of an experience. And, you know, as you grow up, you recognize what's really important. And, you know, I think that I could have, through all of what we dealt with, I think that, you know, you become an adult and you say, you know what, what is really important to me? And it's my friendship and my love and my feelings for you and for our children and our child. And, you know, that's the bottom line for me.
you end your book with this letter that you reference, and he says, so this is a birth note, baby, and when I get back, everything will be different. We're going to have a life together, Aang, I promise. I'm going to concentrate on my health. I'm going to become a public hermit. I'm going to get my master's degree. I'm going to write short stories and movie scripts. Who knows? I might even get a tan. You know, he was 30 years old.
Yeah. He'd only been in California for 2 weeks before and he'd only come home for the weekend. So he really had been on the road for 2 years, 300 and some concerts a year, and we barely saw each other. Right. And we had just lost a child. We'd lost our second son. And I think that's really what turned him around, was the realization that life's going way too fast, and I've got to slow down. Anyway, he came home, and it was the best weekend we'd ever spent together. And we'd been talking on the phone every single day. I mean, no matter what was happening, even if there were women in the room, he was calling me. And it was really, like our friendship and our love was really tight. And when we did music, that was making love for us. Music was making love. So, you know, when we weren't able to make love, we were able to make music. And when he left that time, we had just spent 3 hours making music together. And, you know, he wanted so much to do another album with me and to do all kinds of stuff.
He was killed in 1973. He was on this little plane with Maury Muehlheisen and the two of them. It sounded as if it was pilot error.
Yes.
Did they call you? Is that how you found out that?
Actually, my stepmom called me. She had been watching the Today Show. No one called me. And she called to tell me that, she said, I was just watching the Today Show. Are you okay? And it was 4 a.m. in California and San Diego. And she said, are you okay? And I said, yes, but I was having this very strange dream that I really needed Jim. I kept calling him and he wasn't there. And so when she said to me, there was a plane crash, and I said, and Jim's gone, right? And she said, yes. And I said, and Maury too? And she said, yes, everyone in the plane went down. And it was just, okay, I'll talk with you later kind of thing. And
what did you do after he died? It was you and AJ, your son?
Well, let's see. I mean, I really didn't know what to do. The first thing that happened, as I remember it, is I got a call from Dick Clark. And he said, Ingrid, we're going to be doing the first American Music Awards. And Jim was nominated in two categories, and I would love to have you come to the show. And I remember I had no money, and I didn't know what to do. And then eventually a check came in from ASCAP to the estate of Jim Croce. And up until that point in time, we just received this $200 a week. That was it. And when I got this check, I was absolutely amazed. Where did this money come from? I'd never seen so much money at one time. And then I recognized that the money that I had received was the money we should have been receiving. The checks had been going somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And the ASCAP money that we should have been receiving for airplay was finally coming in. So I asked for an audit and ended up in a litigation. But because I didn't want to deal with the pain, I got involved in the litigation, trying to figure out why Jim had to die without having recognized his financial security. Because to Jim, you know, money wasn't important, but security was important. And he never, ever got that. And that was really something that I could get angry about, you know. I've never really mourned Jim until I met Jimmy.
Your current husband. Yeah.
Yes. I think that the pain was just too great. Huh. And when I finally met Jimmy 25 years ago and we started to do this book, I think that's when I really started to mourn him.
Like the pine trees lining the winding road, I've got a name, I've got a name.
That was my conversation with Ingrid Croce about her late husband, singer-songwriter Jim Croce, who would have turned 72 last week. This has been Radio Times in Review. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org and tell us what you think of the show. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks so much for listening.
Rolling me down the highway, rolling me down the highway.